The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guests, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises, or the underwriters of this station.
Hello, and welcome to Dig This, Pearl on Politics with Professor David Pearl. Pearl on Politics airs the second Saturday of the month. Good morning, Professor Pearl.
Good morning, Pamela. Well, I am joined here in the studio by Pamela Spato, by Craig Boyer, who are both my co-hosts, and by Shane Houchins, our engineer. Craig and Pamela, how are you today?
Very good.
So far, so good. I'm looking forward to this exciting show today.
I am too. And for our listeners, I want to wish everyone a happy Veterans Day, but I also want to tell our listeners a bit of a second disclaimer. And the second disclaimer is that I've had about 4 hours of sleep, and this will be a very interesting show. Well, we're going to do something a little bit different today in honor of the McLaughlin NewsHour on PBS. We are going to present a number of issues and have a roundtable discussion with my co-hosts, Pamela and Craig. Now, to start, I wanted to discuss issue one. And issue one is the bombshell that Donna Brazile, former head of the Democratic National Committee, released earlier in the week. Mrs. Brazile inherited a party that was in chaos. Mrs. Brazile inherited a party from a distraught and mal-suited Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who was accused of impropriety, and we'll get to that in a bit. Mrs. Brazile also inherited a party that was deeply, deeply in the red. What do we mean by that? Mrs. Brazile released an article in the Politico magazine this week where she said that the Democratic National Committee was, in fact, so deeply in the red that they required the Clinton campaign to settle their debts, that they were not able to pay for their staffers, that they were put on, in her words, a lifeline allowance or something similar. I forget the wording verbatim. Effectively, they were given by the Clinton campaign just enough money to operate week in and week out. Now, this is, of course, in 2016, during the Democratic primary, a primary that Mrs. Clinton did not run unopposed. Of course, she ran against Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, whose populist support seemed to outpace Mrs. Clinton's in every category. For those of you that will remember the primary elections of 2016, Mr. Sanders drew incredibly large crowds, whereas Mrs. Clinton's were described by one reporter as, quote, anemic at best. Her popular support was, well, almost unfounded. It was assumed, though, that because of her advantage in terms of her ability to raise funds, particularly from corporate sources, particularly from the banking sector, that she would be effectively crowned with the, or coronated maybe is a better word, as the Democratic Party's nominee for the general election. Well, fast forward to days before the first Democratic Party debate between Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Sanders. And it was discovered through leaked memoranda that Mrs. Brazile had indeed fed the Clinton campaign the questions in advance of this debate that she would have with Mr. Sanders. And even though she received the questions in advance, it seemed to any objective onlooker that Mr. Sanders did quite well indeed. Yet there's a bigger story here, the story of what Mrs. Brazile would later go on this week to call a takeover of the Democratic Party. This takeover included paying this monthly stipend, this effective allowance to the DNC to allow them to operate and operate without, while maintaining dependence on Mrs. Clinton and her campaign. And we have looked at a number of questions and concerns about this story, and I wanted to field a couple as well, maybe right now. Pamela, you had some questions that you had about this story.
Yes, and because I had been doing a little bit of research or a lot of research about the Donna Brazile story, because it is rather fascinating. And one question in my that came to mind was, what is in store for the DNC? But before we get there, and I think we're going to be addressing that later, I certainly hope so, because it's like, my goodness. But the idea that one article that I read said that the DNC was broke, it was bankrupt. And I wanted to know, how can that be? You know, so Hillary Rodham Clinton was funneling money into the DNC, but there were also, from another article, there were donations that were given to the DNC. However, that were supposed to go to states for the elections, the Democratic elections in the state, but the states. But the idea was that it was going to the state party, but they had to send back.
That's right.
And I would go, well, that doesn't make any sense.
It's likely quite a bit worse than that. It is very likely, and we don't have all of the evidence yet. So this is, for our listeners, just speculation, though likely in the next week or so we'll find this out to be fact. It is likely that this money that was raised by the DNC for DNC down-ticket candidates, candidates at the local level, candidates at the state level, that this was in some way sent to the Clinton campaign for redistribution to her chosen candidates throughout the state and local level. Now, there's a problem with this. Let's say I, as a donor, wanted to donate to the DNC. And I had every expectation that my donation was going to this organization, the Democratic National Committee, maybe to a particular candidate's political action committee that was managed by the DNC. Well, I can only assume that that money would actually go to the person that I donated to. When you run into a third party claiming the money or receiving the money, you run into significant problems that could be filed with the FEC. Let me explain what I mean by that. The Federal Election Commission mandates that if you donate to a political action committee, if you donate to what we call a super PAC or super political action committee, that every citizen that donates to these two groups must have their name registered by that group with the FEC. That way we know who's donating to what political party. Now, PACs and super PACs work slightly differently. A political action committee is allowed to coordinate with candidates, meaning they can ask candidates directly, how should we spend this money that we're raising? Political action committees can only raise $2,700 per person or per source. And that's to avoid corruption so that we don't have somebody purchasing a candidate, right? But they must report their donors to the FEC. Now, a super PAC functions a little bit differently. They are not allowed to directly coordinate with candidates. They're not legally allowed to coordinate with candidates. This is to avoid corruption because super PACs are allowed to raise unlimited amounts of money. And if what I suspect happened is true, many people that donated to various PACs that were supported by the DNC in the hope that they were delivering their money, their hard-earned money, to one source or another, actually ended up getting their money siphoned off from this Hillary for President group, which may have found its way into sources that would, it may not have been the source that they wanted to donate to originally. Incidentally, there's a third funding source for campaigns, and it's a source that is a little bit cheeky at best, and it's called a 501c4 organization. Now, a 501c4 organization is so named because it's part of the tax code. 501c4 is the area of the tax code that deals with what they call issue advocacy groups. And issue advocacy groups, they are allowed to raise unlimited amounts of money. They also, like super PACs, are not allowed to coordinate directly with candidates, but they don't have to report to the FEC, any of their donors, so long as they don't use words in their material, in their propaganda that they put out that have what the Supreme Court in a 1979 decision called election wording. So as long as they don't use words like vote for, vote against, show up to the polls, as long as they don't use 14 of these so-called magic words, this is called the magic words test that the Supreme Court put forward, they can avoid giving their donors to the FEC. Now, anyone that's seen a political ad sponsored by one of these 501c4s will note that while they legally don't say go out and vote for one candidate or another, it is clear who they are supporting and who they are trying to, cast aspersions on. And this leads a lot of people to say, look, these 501c4s are skirting the process. They are effectively allowing millionaires and billionaires to send as much money as they want in the dark without public scrutiny. What I worry more than anything else, and I hope this isn't the case, I hope that it was just minor corruption and not massive corruption, that we don't have a case of, you know, somebody's hard-earned money going to the DNC being expedited to some issue advocacy group or to some super PAC or even somewhere where they did not intend to support, i.e. the Hillary Clinton campaign. Again, not a very positive answer for you, unfortunately.
Well, could I ask a follow-up, just a short follow-up question? According to the latest article that I read in Salon and in Rolling Stone, the suggestion was that nothing that Donna Brazile exposed was inherently illegal.
It has this icky bad feeling to it.
Right. It's not a good thing.
So you'll notice what she left out. She left out the fact that she gave the Clintons, this is of her book, by the way. She wants to tell, quote, her story.
Yes.
She left out of her story the bit about her feeding Mrs. Clinton answers questions prior to the Democratic debates.
I didn't realize that. She doesn't have that in her book.
She does not. Now let's rewind.
Wow. So,
it's surprising, Craig. I know it's very surprising that she wouldn't include incriminating
something so important as
see,
that.
See, I thought somebody else had done that. Truthfully,
it was Mrs. Brazile. Now let's.
I'll be darned.
I knew she'd done it, but I thought if she's going to write a tell-all book, she'd put that in there.
Right. She'd tell all, right?
Well, again, maybe she wants to avoid impropriety. But let's rewind a little bit to immediately following the revelations that Mrs. Brazile had given Mrs. Clinton, her campaign, that information. Immediately following, a intrepid lawyer and Bernie Sanders supporter, who, you will forgive me, I forget his name, filed a class action lawsuit against the DNC. And his claim was that the people that participated in the primary were systematically disenfranchised, and he filed a sort of classic fraud lawsuit. And the DNC response was simple. It was, we are under no obligation, legal or otherwise, to provide the same sort of safeguards that you'd find in the general election. Meaning, yes, we lied, we favored one candidate, and we are legally not responsible to answer to those lies and that favoring. Now, to get to your question, did she do something illegal? Probably not. I think we can all justify, we can all say that this was immoral behavior. Certainly, members of the Democratic Party should
be
chagrined.
It's like giving answers to the test.
Yeah, very much so. In advance.
That doesn't wash.
No, it does not.
Well, what about the notion, Professor Pearl, that the Democratic Party or the DNC, rather than being expansive, really just kind of shrunk into it's going to be Clinton. We're not going to let diverse voices in. We're not going to have, you know, why not just let Bernie Sanders fully participate or another candidate fully participate? And the idea, a part of the idea is that all that would do would be harm Clinton because you'd be attacking people within your own party.
Yeah.
So we're just going to shrink it. It just seems like the DNC should be expansive, that we need to be talking about these issues and having real debates.
You would hope so. Now, I think, and I'm going to get to your question in kind of a roundabout way, but I think to do so, a little bit of history is necessary. There's this notion in political science of what we call the Overton window. And the Overton window is the acceptable space by which one can operate ideologically. What do I mean by that? Well, let's say the country is moving rightward. The Overton window might be that space between the far right and the sort of center right that one could presumably win an election and fill some seat if they campaigned as a center right party member. American politics has shifted its Overton window for the last 20 years progressively more and more rightward. And what you'll notice is exactly what President Obama observed. President Obama said, look, if I was running in the 1990s, I would be considered a moderate Republican. And he's right.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We are in this area, or in this era, I should say. And again, you'll excuse me. I've had about 4 hours of rest. We're in this particular point in history where we're not casting a big net. We are not including people on the left. We're not even sometimes including people on the center left. This is a right-wing corporate party dominated by folks who receive their funding from millionaires and billionaires and corporations, sometimes in an unaccountable way.
Yes.
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 I sort of trailed it off there. I apologize.
No, yeah, I mean, that's really very interesting, because I was also thinking of Dwight Eisenhower, and he was indeed a Republican. Mm-hmm. And this just goes right along with what you're saying. And he was saying, beware, right? Beware the military-industrial complex and the money going to the military-industrial complex, because it's going to take away from social programs. Mm-hmm. If he were alive today and saying that, he would not be considered
a Republican at
all. A good Republican.
Not at all. He'd be considered a radical Democrat.
So we have been, unfortunately, this is just kind of a mind blower, but it's true. I mean, that we have been moving consistently to the right, and anything towards the left is demonized and vilified. And so by the Democratic Party, just what you were saying, the DNC shrinking in terms of diversity, that is just making that very much more corporate and right-leaning.
And let's be realistic, right? This is where the money is. If your campaign is based on running fancy advertisements and newspaper buys, you're not going to get that from raising money from working people. You're going to get that on Wall Street. Now, you talked about Eisenhower. We could even look at somebody like Richard Nixon, right? I mean, Nixon was viewed as a right-wing monster in his day, and quite rightly so, a criminal, if you will, and quite rightly so there as well. But he still passed, the Clean Water
Act? Clean Water Act. Right? He did environmental.
OSHA. I think he helped institute OSHA.
Yeah, he did. Right. He did. Now, let's fast forward to today. He would be on the far left of the Democratic Party, right? Which is, it boggles the mind.
It truly does.
Oh. We are going to break rather quickly for station identification.
And this is KKRN in Bella Vista, 88.5. And in case you just tuned in, we are listening to Professor Pearl with Pearl on Politics. I'm Pamela Spoto, and also in the studio is Craig Boyer. So, Professor Pearl, do you think, is this the time that you would, I'm wondering, what is going to be the future of the DNC and the Republican Party as well? Do you foresee possibly a third party coming in or more parties besides just the two-party system? Is that possible?
Let me start with the easier of the two questions, dealing with the Republican Party. The Republican Party, according to the press, is broken. It's fractured, torn asunder by the wild antics of Donald Trump. But in reality, this is far from the truth. In reality, if you look at the way the Republican Party, at least their operatives at the national level, operate, it is in unison, it is in lockstep, and it is in a much more controlled fashion than the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party, you get, the old saying goes, you get, 50 Democrats in a room, you'll have 51 opinions, right? Though the Republican Party may speak to, Donald Trump's moral behavior as immoral as it should be. In terms of voting, in terms of supporting every single, cockamamie and radical idea he's put forward, you will find a difficult time, finding all but a fringe element not in lockstep support. And that's for almost every single issue, barring one, the wall with Mexico there. I think there is some, there's a significant lack of funding to pursue the other major Republican goal, which is to give titanic amounts of public wealth into the hands of private interests. And when you have to build something new, an infrastructure project on the side of a giant, quote unquote, great wall, perhaps laden with gold, as Mr. Trump has one time promised, on our southern border, we are talking about $1, $2 trillion that could otherwise go to the pockets of their donors. So, no, I don't think that there will be a collapse of the Republican Party. The Democratic Party, on the other hand, I am much more hopeful, will, in fact, well, effectively either reform or be radically supplanted by a third party. And we saw, you know, right before the show, Pamela and I were discussing the prospects for the Green Party. And Dr. Jill Stein did a tremendous job this this election cycle, winning probably the most since Ralph Nader, as far as the Green Party was able to attract, though being demonized in the press, being demonized as, quote, a Russian operative, as, quote, tofu Putin, as, quote, a lackadaisical, and what was the other word? Something to do with being sort of a hippie, whatever that means, just insulted in all sorts of pejorative ways. Right. I would hope that people would eventually realize the potential in the Green Party or in DSA or any of these other organizations on what I would consider really the center left. I think the Democratic Party is into the right at this point. But here's the bargain that goes into people's heads. Right. They get into that voting booth and they say, look, can I vote for a third party candidate or do I vote for the Democrat? Then they say, you know, well, am I throwing my vote away? Am I throwing my vote away when I vote for Jill Stein or when I vote for, you know, Bernie Sanders is running for re-election in Vermont as an independent. He is a self-described democratic socialist. Again, at the national level, you might not be able to win elections as a democratic socialist in sort of left of center Vermont. They seem to be okay with it.
Yes. And since you did bring up Dr. Jill Stein, I just don't. Well, what a wonderful platform. And maybe we could just go there just for 1 minute.
Let's start with issue two, Jill Stein.
Oh, is that issue two?
Issue two.
Oh, my goodness. Well, this is wonderful.
Yeah. I think I'll add the McLaughlin music in the background to this cast. Yeah.
Well, good. So go right ahead, Professor Pearl.
Sure. So let's talk about the Green Party. Let's talk about their platform, right? Now let's talk about the major component, and that is what they call a Green New Deal. A Green New Deal. If we are to believe that, you know, 500-pound gorilla in the room that we call modern science, we are on the precipice of environmental disaster.
Yes.
Absolute disaster. Now, whether or not you believe in anthropogenic global warming, in other words, global warming caused by man, or whether you believe that this is caused by other natural functions, maybe the sun is too hot or some other idea. One has to acknowledge that there are ways that we can influence, albeit slightly, the climate around us, and perhaps the job of the state should be in funding projects to effectively alleviate the amount of CO2 emission, which is causing our planet to shift in weather patterns rapidly. Now, the term used to be global warming, and you'd have every right-wing conspiracy nut in the world out there saying, oh, it's snowing, there can't be global warming. But really, the term is more effectively, the more effective term is climate change. What we see is erratic and continually more erratic changes in the climate, meaning you'll have greater frequency of tropical storms. And here again, you'll have people saying, well, there are just as many hurricanes today as there are in 2000 or 1990. But what they are counting are the sort of the what meteorologists call the category of the hurricane. the actual number of tropical storms has increased radically. I mean, when we are talking by an order of magnitude more. So we have an increase in erratic weather patterns, hurricanes, areas of the a planet with marked differences in terms of their temperature. And here again, you see the radical conspiracy theorists that we all, you know, we all have a friend or two on our social media that posts something about, well, it's, you know, very, very cold in November. I'm living in, you know, northern wherever. You know, climate change can't be real. But if we take what scientists call ice samples, and ice samples are a effective drilling into the Earth's core where there is ice that's been sitting around for eon, and we can measure the amount of carbon that was stored in these ice samples. And again, I'm not a scientist. I am a political scientist. So if I'm not getting the actual science correct here, one of our listeners can call in and tell us the actual term. But the point is we can see a marked difference since the start of the Industrial Revolution. And the Green Party's ticket is one that seeks to alleviate the stress on our environment. That's point one, this Green New Deal. Point two is what I would dub a pro democracy, little d democracy platform, one where every party has access to the polls. Currently, we have a two-party duopoly that limits control of the ballot box to these two gigantic companies.
It is corporate.
No, I guess it was a Freudian slip.
Yes,
absolutely, absolutely. This is my train driving through a mountain or whatever. Absolutely. And these are very real barriers. They are barriers to entry for small parties. This is why, you see the occasional member of the Green Party or DSA winning in a place like Seattle, Washington, or San Francisco, or some other liberal bastion. But why we don't see them in, you know, Chattanooga or Columbus, Ohio, or Lexington, Kentucky. Now, there's a litany of other major Green Party platforms, including their international stance on promoting peace instead of war. This is likely immediately in the crosshairs of both Democratic Party and Republican Party donors who make money off the or who profiteer off of war, death, and destruction the world over.
And I certainly wholeheartedly agree with that. And what I'm wondering, Professor Pearl, is I'm thinking that we could take a short music break.
When
we come back, I have a couple of questions about the Green Party platform. And that includes why it may be difficult for people to get a grasp on. And yet it's so important because on one hand, we say we want peace. We're fighting for peace. Talk about oxymoronic. But here is a party that's saying, you know, it's pro-peace. We're going to try diplomatic. We're going to try peaceful ways of discussing and negotiating in the world. And this is like a cliche, I think. You know, if I have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Mm-hmm. If I have the largest military weaponry in the world, everything looks like I should drop a bomb on it. That's a solution. Yeah. And that is just so wrong. And
the
so,
phrase, Pamela, as we go out to break, is bombs for peace. Mm-hmm. Bombs for peace.
Oh, I see. Well, here we go.
I had a dream the other night. Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich. How much can she take? How much can she give? How much is too much, and how much longer can she live? As we turn our backs and turn our eyes and pretend we don't see. If ignorance is bliss, then full of bliss are we. As we take, 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 take. Like a good mother, Mother Nature keeps giving, but her heart must be ready to break. She's being abused and overused by her children who choose to ignore. There's only so much that she can give before she can give no more. Let's take our heads out of the sand and stick our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. We poison the air, we poison the land, and we poison the water we drink. And we're the only known creatures in the whole universe with the ability to think. But we keep on thinking, having us lies and how much we buy and sell. And more of paradise is lost, and only time will tell what will become of Mother Nature in the coming years. When we will have about 10 billion neighbors on this sphere, will our children's children wake up to the American dream? Or will it have become a nightmare beyond imagining? Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. We use so much and waste so much. How much do we really need? And how long can a dream survive that seems to thrive on greed? Political pollution is so thick and dark and dense. It contaminates and poisons common good and common sense. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. Let me not greed lead the way.
Welcome back to Pearl on Politics with Professor Pearl. Professor Pearl, you right before break, we were talking about the Green Party platform, and I did have a couple of questions to ask you about.
Absolutely.
That because I just really like the Green Party platform, but I'm wondering, in terms of any kind of third party, in a way, it would seem that it would take a change of consciousness on our parts.
Yeah.
And in terms of the Green New Deal and being more environmentally conscious, just recently, within the last 2 weeks,
yeah,
Tyson Foods has been in the news because they're one of, if not the largest, producer of certain kinds of meats and so forth.
Yeah.
Their pollution and the creation of dead zones, the largest dead zone in U.S. history, according to Alternet, in the Gulf of Mexico, because what happens not only from the manure ponds, yeah, but also from the feed that they are feeding the cattle, the nitrates and so forth go into the rivers and then mm-hmm. goes out into the ocean. And so in order for us to get some cheap meat, yeah, a lot of cheap meat, we're killing the oceans.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so, I mean, is this even possible that we can have this change of consciousness? When you try to tell people or even suggest to people, maybe you want to eat less meat, yeah, not that
very
you want to be vegan.
No, you don't have to be vegetarian, but just eat a very, very small portions, not all the time.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean,
it would go a long way. Now there's a second problem there, in that the developing world now is reaching a high living standard, even if not the entire population of China. Suddenly tomorrow has enough money to eat meat on a daily basis. Certainly their middle class, which is about 300 million strong, are developing an appetite for meat that the rest of the country did not have 10 years ago. And when you have a new 300 million population, and again, China's population is over a billion in total, but those wealthy individuals who made money, particularly on the coast, from the industrialization of China, we might talk about that in a bit, they are demanding more and more beef, more and more chicken. Now, you mentioned this dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico and what we can do to stop it. And I want to look at what happened in my previous home, Central Ohio. I grew up in Central Ohio for the most part. And Central Ohio during the 1980s was the home of the largest egg producer in the country, a group called Buckeye Egg. Now, you'd know you were close to a Buckeye Egg facility by the smell. You'd be within 5 miles. You smelled just foul, disgusting smells that you would not want to talk about over the radio. And local farmers who owned fields and who owned other animal-producing stockyards close to them complained, right? One fields began to go fallow around these large dump sites. As you mentioned, the runoff from just the waste that many of these chickens produce is slightly detrimental to the water table in terms of quality. Two, because these are chickens that are not fed in the normal way a chicken would be fed. They are literally pumped with antibiotics, and with corn products. Now, again, in the wild, I've never seen a chicken that hunts an ear of corn. You know, they scavenge things off the ground, of course. And I've never seen a chicken that has developed the penicillin or similar antibiotic. Yet because of their close confines, what we have our good friend Derek Jensen has called chicken coop concentration camps, effectively putting chickens literally next to each other so they have very little movement. What that causes is a tremendous quick spread of disease. So in order to keep these animals alive effectively before harvest, they have to pump them full of two things, antibiotic and corn products, to plump them up.
There's another thing, Professor Pearl. Yeah. They use ground up parts of dead chickens that are diseased and what have you. Yeah. And so they grind them up and put them in feed.
Yeah, what's disturbing about that is in some of the other stockyard animals, particularly cattle, this can cause the mad cow disease that we saw outbreak in Argentina and elsewhere.
Yes.
So what happened in central Ohio? It was what we call a market-based solution. In other words, Buckeye Egg began to purchase land around them in greater and greater concentric rings. Now, that was with private land. You know, what happens in the Gulf of Mexico, where, well, what are you going to do, buy a chunk of the ocean and hope that no one notices the absolute level of pollution you've entailed? No. I mean, this is something that needs to be solved at the, I apologize, something needs to be solved on the community level. And I agree. This needs to be a change in how we operate. Now, we've also talked about other changes to our democratic system. And Craig, you mentioned that in parliamentary systems, we have a multitude of parties, and the parties have to negotiate with themselves in order to effectively build a consensus.
That's right. They don't have to say my way or the highway.
Yeah. They have
to. That makes a difference.
A vote of confidence is one that includes many different parties. It's not, you're right, my way or the highway. It's not sort of a monolithic, and in fact, what we could consider the U.S., a single party state, right? I mean, there's not much substantive difference between the Democrats and the Republicans along anything but social issues. I mean, you ask a Democrat and a Republican what they believe on the issue of gay marriage, you might get a very different idea. You ask them on what they believe about Wall Street, well, you're going to have a very similar opinion.
Kind of
yeah, yeah. Well, let's move to issue three.
All right.
Issue three, Julian Assange.
Yes.
Today, the Crown Prosecution Services, this is the portion of the British state responsible for discussing current cases with other governments, admitted that they, quote unquote, deleted a number of emails between them and the Swedish prosecutors of Mr. Julian Assange, who has been, in my mind, unjustly accused of the crime of rape. Now, this is a serious crime, and we have a mountain of evidence that we've discussed in previous programs, including the testimony by the women involved in the alleged attack. That they willingly engaged in a sexual liaison with Mr. Assange. And again, this is a PG-13 show, so we're not going to go into the specifics, right? So we can't talk much about Assange or Mr. Clinton or Mr. Gingrich and their personal lives or anything that Donald Trump says for that matter. But...
Or Judge Roy Moore.
Yeah. Oh, that's horrible. And for those of our... I think I do want to touch on that for a second. For those of our listeners that don't know about this, Republican Roy Moore was accused of having a sexual liaison with a 14-year-old girl. And if you think that's horrible enough, Moore, when he was working in Alabama, it's Alabama, right? I believe it's Alabama where he used to be a judge. While working in this courtroom environment, he would wait outside of the courtroom where there would be family law cases going on in order to troll and stalk young women in desperate life circumstances. And he would offer rides to some of these girls, some as young as reportedly 14, 13. And according to the person in question, he groped her, raped her.
He was in his 30s.
He was beyond the age of 18 at that point, obviously.
Well beyond.
Right. So this is a if these accusations are born to be correct, because, again, everyone deserves their day in court. This fellow also deserves condemnation.
And Professor Pearl, I don't mean to interrupt, but I am interrupting you.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know that over the last 8 months, in terms of Julian Assange, I mean, you have been saying, you know, let's look at the information, let's look at the data. These are alleged charges, and people just want to jump to conclusions, you know, hasty conclusion. He's charged, he's guilty.
Right.
But in my opinion, because of Julian Assange's activities in terms of WikiLeaks and so forth, that there's really been a witch hunt after him, and using anything, and just this last revelation between the British police or enforcement and the Swedish prosecutors.
Yeah.
It is revealed that, you know, and that we should be looking at all the information. We should be looking at the arguments and so forth.
And let's be perfectly clear. The reason why Mr. Assange is so persecuted is for, of course, as you mentioned, the WikiLeaks activity. But that includes the outing of Mrs. Clinton's activities during the campaign that we spoke about earlier. That also includes some of the crimes perpetrated in Iraq against Iraqis by both U.S. Soldiers and U.S. What they call private contractors.
Yes.
It's a fancy word for mercenaries for the rest of our audience.
Yes.
So we are, I mean, I don't want to say happy to see that the mask has come off of the Crown Prosecution Services. But certainly this is a big day for those of us that are seeking justice in the Assange case.
And Professor Pearl, do you think, I mean, it was suggested or a question was asked, now can Assange seek, not only seek, he's been granted asylum in Ecuador, the country itself, that he should be allowed to go there. Do you see that happening?
No, I mean, he's being held, obviously. He'll be arrested and immediately deported to the U.S., where he'll face espionage charges and thrown in a deep dungeon. If we looked at the amount of time that Chelsea Manning, that she spent in solitude, effectively, I think it was 5 years, something around that, sometimes being left in a cold room with no bed, sometimes being left with just a blanket, sometimes having dogs barking in her face. We see what the U.S. state does to those that they view as traitors, those they view as giving up sensitive information. You get the idea. In a great act of immorality, Mrs. Manning, she is released. Now, that's not the immorality. She is pardoned by President Obama. But when she leaves prison, she's offered a job as a visiting fellow at Harvard University, and shamefully, Harvard denies her appointment because a number of other, shall we say, former members of the one administration or another, or folks who are deeply associated with
donors, money.
Well, indeed, they threw a fit, right?
Yes.
One other visiting fellow, who we won't name and give him extra airtime because he's not a very important intellectual anyway, claimed that it would be an insult if she was allowed to stay at Harvard. In any case.
Was the last name Summers?
unfortunately, well, I don't want to go into names of other potential colleagues.
So in a way, I mean, and this is kind of a question with naivete, is that Chelsea Manning was tried to bring this information to go through the chain of command.
Correct.
and she was just dismissed. But I mean, to bring to light war crimes.
Yeah.
That seems, those are things that the American public, the U.S. public should know.
Yeah.
And this is what whistleblowers oftentimes are trying to, or often are trying to show. And yet now our stance on this is there's, we're not protecting whistleblowers.
Yeah.
And maybe it was a myth to think that we have throughout history when indeed that may not have been the case at all.
And this is exactly why Edward Snowden released information the way he did. He stole it from a compound in Hawaii where he was stationed. And he immediately moved it to Hong Kong, gave it to some very good journalists who now work for the paper called The Intercept. Now he is living on the lam, being given refuge by Russia, not because Russia is particularly kind to whistleblowers, but because they wanted to, you know, thumb their nose in the eye of then President President Obama. We're going to do a quick break for station identification. You're listening to KKRN. KKRN is a community and listener-supported radio station. We are all volunteers at KKRN 88.5 FM. You are listening to Pearl on Politics with Dr. David Pearl, with Craig Boyer, and with Pamela Spato. We are the news of the North State.
We are indeed.
So
come here for your latest news.
Indeed, indeed. let's continue the McLaughlin line and talk about issue four.
All right.
Issue four, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul attacked at his home, attacked by his neighbor. Four ribs broken by Senator Rand Paul's neighbor. The dispute was over, quote, a landscaping argument. Landscaping. Now, I have owned property before. I have been a avid mower of my lawn. I have grown a number of edible crops in my lawn. And never have I had a dispute over my quality of landscaping or care. Now, typically, when neighbors get into arguments, it is over other things. Maybe there is a, an affair. Maybe there is a dispute over a contentious issue. Maybe somebody parked in the wrong space, something like that. But never over landscaping. So we will keep an eye on this, little mishap.
Perpetrated by a fellow doctor.
Indeed, indeed. These are both dentists, I believe. So may they hang out in the same social circles. And I'm just positing here.
Dentist to dentist.
They work together.
Dentist on dentist violence. This is the biggest driver of crime, dentists.
I wouldn't have thought a dentist could break four ribs.
Right, four ribs. Now,
teeth maybe.
I am positing that there is something else to this story.
I think you're right.
That maybe we'll find that at some social function, maybe somebody said the wrong thing to somebody else's partner, and it got dirty in the mowing of the lawn. Issue number four. Issue five. Mark Cuban. Mark Cuban has announced, and Mark Cuban, for those of you that don't know, is the billionaire owner of the Dallas Mavericks. He has announced that he wants to enter politics, and why wouldn't he, right? Why wouldn't he? After all, the only qualification one needs in American politics is to be a billionaire, is to have enough money and gall and seemingly celebrity appeal to draw out the, lowest common denominator. We are entering into an era where we may see Mark Cuban versus Donald Trump versus The Rock, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, in the next presidential election cycle. And you might say, look, you know, we've seen celebrities in the past. We saw in Minnesota, Jesse, quote unquote, the body, Ventura, win the governorship. Now, Jesse is a very bright individual, and I don't want to cast aspersions on him. But America's love affair with actors and celebrities really has stepped back to the Reagan era. Right.
Reagan and Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Schwarzenegger, right. I mean, let's look at that, right? So the early part of this century, California faced an energy crisis. And our bills went up precipitously to, I think, something like 200-300% of what they were. Then California Governor Gray Davis is blamed, right?
Yes.
And a petition goes around for a particular process by which he can be recalled, called the recall.
Yes.
Which I was looking for. Again, 4 hours of sleep.
I was thinking impeachment, but it is recall.
It's a recall.
It's a recall.
And enough votes are metered out. Now, without talking about the victor of that case, of that contest, which was ultimately Mr. Schwarzenegger, what was going on? Previous to Mr. Davis's tenure as governor of California. Both parties in the California state legislature had deregulated our energy markets, meaning that energy producers and energy producers could move energy without a tax or tariff from one state to another. Now, if you can move energy either virtually or literally, physically, over a vast distance, and you have some loss of the energy over the distance, but instantly, sometimes without even moving the energy, you can create artificial demand in one area or another. And that's exactly what they did.
Enron, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. The companies that were in charge of this trading were artificially creating a supply and demand that was inconsistent with the amount of energy that we had.
And this is so terrible because I remember listening to some of there were tape recordings, phone recordings of Enron officials that were just laughing there.
Oh, yeah.
They were laughing.
Yeah.
And people were experiencing brownouts and blackouts, and it was just to bump up the price.
Yeah. I mean, you could almost hear the laughter.
It was, and they say, laughing about grandma. Well, she's going to suffer.
That's right.
Yes, yes.
That's right.
Well, that's a fun thing. You know,
right.
We're going to make money on this deal.
Right. Some horrible circumstance we're going to laugh at. Awful.
And this is a huge question. So but it's not really a question that I want to spend time with. It's that how in a democracy, by definition of democracy, is it the billionaire that now is the one that is going to be they're the ones that are now get in office. They're the ones that are controlling Congress, the billionaires. And people talk about this is a democracy. It sounds like an oligarchy, a plutocracy to me.
And even our popular culture is geared towards the glamorization of people with obscene amounts of wealth. Let's look at 1950s and 60s classic comic book Batman right here. The dashing Bruce Wayne has a dramatic childhood experience where his very rich patrician family is murdered, and he goes on a vigilante spree to clean up the city as he grows into adulthood. Now, this is an eccentric billionaire. He doesn't use the police. He goes out and solves crime by himself, encountering one supervillain after another and dispensing of them. We're meant to cheer for this person existing in the extrajudicial landscape of vigilantism. That coupled with other rather bizarre formulas to the story. I mean, he's living with his young ward, Robin, another child that he picks up off the street. I mean, the examples are bizarre, but you get the idea. We glamorize the wealthy. I mean, there's never, living on the street, homeless Dr. Pearl, after anyone hears this radio broadcast, homeless Dr. Pearl suddenly decides to start fighting crime. No, they'd be labeled something different, right? Issue 6.
Oh,
let's move to issue 6.
Okay.
And let's get away from issue number 5. Saudi Prince fallout, issue number 6. Just this week, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, the son of King Salman, launched what I would describe as a palace coup, taking into custody a slew of Saudi officials, claiming that they engaged in corruption and launching what he called, what the state calls, an anti-corruption probe. Now, corruption is dime a dozen in Saudi Arabia. You could potentially figure out any prince within the Saudi family, and you will note that they are trying to avoid three things: taxation, accountability, and paying anyone other than themselves out of the money that they receive. And it's a patronage system where members of the Saudi royal family receive a stipend every month from the oil sales of the Saudis' state-owned oil company. Now, interestingly enough, many of these billionaires that were detained had money sitting in Saudi banks. And the prince expropriated that for himself. Well, quote unquote, for the Saudi state. Since it's a monarchy, it's for himself. Also, interestingly enough, Saeed Hariri, the prime minister of Lebanon, was visiting Saudi Arabia. And he was allied with one of these princes who were arrested by the crown prince. Mr. Hariri has been detained by Saudi authorities. Mysteriously, he makes this announcement where he looks distressed, he looks unfettered, and he says he is stepping down as the prime minister of Lebanon. But he wants to stay in Saudi Arabia. He doesn't want to fly back, right? Well, he's clearly been kidnapped. This is clearly an attempt to malign Lebanon's regional ally, Iran. Iran is a ally of another Lebanese party called Hezbollah. Hezbollah is an organization that the U.S. and that Israel consider a terror organization. And Hezbollah stands to lose if Hariri does not return. A new prime minister would largely mean that they would lose power in whatever power seeking or sharing arrangement arrives next. So this is, again, a power play by the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia to do two things. One, eliminate rivals. And two, thumb the nose in their regional rival, Iran, that they are able to kidnap a head of state and effectively get away with it. And why wouldn't they? They've been able to get away with committing acts of genocide in nearby Yemen. Yemen, where the ancient city of Sana was effectively turned to rubble, where we have a cholera outbreak in the modern era.
The largest one.
Largest one since, I think, the 1950s. I mean, it's just horrible. Everything's broken and everyone knows it in Yemen. And, for what? There's still an active rebellion because, as it turns out, people don't like being bombed from, multi-million dollar U.S. warplanes being sold to a sub-modern, meaning a less than modern system of government, a monarchy. Right? It is not a modern or reformist state, as they claim. Now, Pamela, you were mentioning earlier that we often hear in the news that the Saudi state is, quote unquote, reforming itself. Right?
Yes.
What was
women,
that?
Women by next year are going to be allowed to drive.
Right, right. Well, that's fantastic. They can keep pace with the world of the early 1900s for the rest of us. Saudi Arabia, for those of you that don't know, is also a state that made slavery illegal in the 1970s, a state where guest workers in the modern era, who make up the majority of most Gulf states, are not given the same legal rights as residents. You can be assaulted, you can be raped, you can be treated like absolute dirt and expect not to have your legal rights respected in any Gulf state if you're a quote-unquote guest worker. I was looking, when I was on the job market, I was looking for jobs. I looked at the Middle East a little bit, and I looked into a number of the rights of guest workers, as I would be. You know, I'd be a highly paid guest worker, and since I'm an American, maybe there's a little bit of privilege that goes with that. But I did not want to take the chance. I don't like to be abused and not have legal recourse if I am.
And it's a strange relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And I would suggest, I suppose it is based on the fossil fuels, the enormous amount of fossil fuels that Saudi Arabia has, and the billions of dollars they have and the weapons they buy.
Yeah.
And so we have this. And the idea that we're going around the world promoting democracy, and Saudi Arabia is not that.
There is a great thought experiment that MIT linguist Noam Chomsky put out. And the thought experiment goes like this. Imagine that the chief export of Saudi Arabia was lettuce and not oil. Well, you get the idea.
Yes.
In any case, I'm going to end the program and hand it over to Pamela, and I'm going to end it in the McLaughlin style. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you, Professor Pearl. For this wonderful show and the McLaughlin Group look-alike. And I need to make several announcements. And so the first one is and I'm just going to read the announcement here. At the end of November, Friends of KKRN Community Radio will have a unique opportunity to support KKRN through North State Giving Tuesday. This special day of giving will be held on Tuesday, November 28th. Donations to KKRN and other Shasta and Siskiyou County nonprofits can be made at northstategives.org from 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time until 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Giving Tuesday is about local people helping local community groups. You can give where you live. If you have any questions about Giving Tuesday or you want to know more about listener-supported KKRN Community Radio, please call 530-337-1101. The number is 530-337-1101. And I really do want to thank Professor Pearl today. Even though he had 4 hours of sleep, it was really interesting show with many important news points. And Craig Boyer, as usual, thank you so much for being here. And next Saturday, we will have, in fact, it's Craig Boyer's show that he hosts, Music with a Message. And his message for next Saturday is gratitude.
Gratitude and Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm. All right. So tune in next Saturday as well. Bye for now.